Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Let me ask Gloria Dickey of Reuters to be next.
If 1.5 is indeed dead, so much of the rhetoric, of course, is keeping 1.5 alive. Our world leaders living in an imaginary world at this point. How long do you expect it will take policy and discussion to catch up? Thank you.
1.5 is deader than Adorno.
I'm Richard Delavan. I'm your host here at Wicked Problems.
That was James Hansen, legendary NASA climate scientist who 35 years ago warned the world about global warming. This week, he tried to shake things up again with a paper that was part science and part sermon. Depending on how you hear it, it might be that part of the movie when the maverick scientist bursts into the Oval Office to tell the president, it's so much worse than you think.
Is this going to hit us?
We're efforting that as we speak, sir.
What kind of damage are we...
Damage? Total, sir. It's what we call a global killer. The end of mankind. Doesn't matter where it hits. Nothing would survive, not even bacteria.
My God. What do we do?
Or, if you hear it a different way, is a voice that just... Well, to be honest, maybe it's just the voice of someone who needs to go lie down for a bit.
We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell... I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Well, if I can stop dating myself with film references that come from before many of you were born, let's hear some more of what Hansen actually had to say, and you can decide for yourself.
And anybody who understands the physics knows that. The assumptions that are made are just inconsistent with the real world and what is happening. We're also going to pass 2 degrees unless we take actions to affect the planet's energy balance. I mentioned that if you want to do it by extracting CO2, it costs you more than $100 trillion. It's not going to happen.
Hansen's paper followed the updated research from Imperial College London in Nature Climate Change this week, which said we've got nearly 20 years less than we thought to get to net zero. Juxtaposed with all the rhetoric this week about tripling renewables by 2030 being the key to keeping 1.5 alive, from COP28, from IRENA, the IEA, tons of corporate sustainability reports, even the big oil companies claim to be committed to the Paris goal of 1.5C, it seems kind of bad. And I don't mind telling you, I've been a little freaked out. So all week I've been asking the smartest people I could get a hold of at the Business Green Net Zero Festival, at an event at Chatham House, on Blue Sky, you'll be there soon, and ringing up experts who might help make sense of it. So we're doing something different, taking a lot of these thoughts and a lot of these conversations and compiling them into 3 episodes. The first one is a conversation that I had on November 3rd with Ketan Joshi. The second episode is a great conversation that's going to drop on Monday with the doyen of climate communications, Susan Joy Hassel, who's collaborated with people like Michael E. Mann, as well as many others you would have heard of. The red thread connecting all these conversations is this. What stories should we be telling about this moment, about the future, and whether we really can do anything about it, or if it's too late? Those stories will help shape how people feel, what you buy, whether to have more children, which companies get investment, which ones you might want to work for, whether government policy makes things better or worse, to make us more likely to think that we're all in this together, or that it's everyone out for themselves, and act accordingly. If you like the session, do check us out at news@wickedproblems.uk. You'll find our newsletter there. You can also find other episodes with myself and co-host Claire Brady. We're also on your favorite podcast app. Tell us what you think and share your ideas for future guests at news.wickedproblems.uk. Find Richard Delavan or Claire Brady on LinkedIn or now Blue Sky. And you'll find links in the show notes, as always. Let's kick things off. Ketan Joshi is the energy data, what Gordon Ramsay is to food. He knows what goes together. He rarely pulls his punches, and he's got a lot of heart. His 2020 book about the very intense Australian climate politics of the first part of the century that he was in the middle of, Windfall, reads like a wartime memoir. A little part of me dies when I see someone under 40 write this well, but I'll try to get over that. He is a senior associate working with a nonprofit doing public advocacy and research on corporate climate commitments. And in his spare time, he's a prolific contributor and community builder on Blue Sky, where I've been spending a lot of time lately. Ketan Joshi, welcome to Wicked Problems.
Hello. Very nice to be here. Thank you for that very nice intro.
It's been such an incredibly busy week for climate and climate tech communications. We've had months leading up to COP28, now happening in a couple of weeks, to rally people around this tripling of renewables target by 2030, and that being a central part of how we stay under 1.5 degrees C. You've been such a prolific writer and communicator about this. We really thought the audience could benefit from getting your take on it. And this week, that campaign for 3X renewables really went into high gear, right? So we had IRENA and the Global Renewables Alliance kicking off their white paper with this nice little infographic saying we get to 11,000 gigawatts made up of 3,500 gigawatts of wind and 5,500 of solar PV. And that campaign was part of this, let's get a good news headline out of COP28, like when we can bank. And we saw the COP28 presidency start this at the beginning of the year. The G20 signed on, led by India. The IEA made it their number one ask for COP. And so if there's like this holy trinity of climate messaging that corporates have internalized, it's this net zero by 2050 in support of staying under 1.5 degrees C. And the institutions were kind of coalescing around that, plus adding this 3X renewables target by 2030 and a lot of multinationals to stay under 1.5. And then this week, we had these controversial new papers drop in Nature and from James Hansen saying, we're actually in deep trouble because the models that say that there's still a path to stay under 1.5 are, in their view, wrong. And even though The Economist ran a cover story a year ago today saying 1.5 was toast, the institutions have been doubling down again and again around 1.5 over the last year. Now, like prominent commentators like Michael Mann or Zeke Hausfather have pushed back on this Hansen paper very, very hard. But before we dig into the 3X renewables thing, I wanted to get your take as a communicator, really learned observer, on how things have played out this week. What do you think?
About 2 years ago, almost, I started to dig much more into the sort of general climate science and emission side of things, right? For about a year before that, I'd been doing a lot of analyzing corporate climate plans, particularly fossil fuel companies. 1.5C as a target would come up a lot. A bunch of scenarios would come up a lot. And then I was like, oh, crap. Okay, now I've got to actually learn what the climate science actually says and read IPCC reports and things like that. At the same time that I started digging into those things, I started seeing more and more instances, scientists themselves or scientific institutions basically saying it's time to start considering giving up on limiting warming to 1.5 degrees as a goal. And it bothered me, I think, somewhat reasonable, like half good reasons and half bad reasons. The actual sort of numbers behind it is simply that we can't pull down on the rate of global change in emissions fast enough. It's just infeasible from a sort of societal or technological perspective, whichever way you sort of mix it around. You couldn't really bring emissions down that fast without some sort of global catastrophe. And it bothered me quite a fair bit because I related it to some very specific debates that I was involved in. So there's a power utility in Australia, for instance, I was writing about at the time.
Right.
They splashed 1.5C all over their sustainability reports as sort of inspirational, optimistic language. Mm. But then they also have a fleet of like 4 coal-fired power stations that are the worst ones in Australia. Right. It's just like these massive concentrated blocks of emissions very easily replaceable. We knew exactly what to do to replace all that power capacity and generation with clean sources. They just decided not to, right? Like, they were just like, well, right, we own these four coal-fired power stations. And I was like, okay, I was seeing this corporation being problematically optimistic about 1.5C while having a very substantial chunk of the world's emissions in their hands in one decision, in one company, and one executive. And at the same time, I started seeing more and more of these scientists basically saying 1.5C is not possible. And I was like, to me at the time, it felt like they were playing into the hands of companies. And I predicted then that more and more companies would start mimicking the language of 1.5C not being possible in justifying fossil fuel extensions or expansions.
Right.
Now, fast forward to 2 years to now, I have learned a lot more about the climate science. And specifically, I have learned about the I guess, probabilities inherent in a lot of these predictions. Mm-hmm. And that specifically was something that really changed my mind a fair bit, which is that there was, even when we talk about 1.5C being possible or impossible, that itself was couched in these percentage chances.
Right.
That I realized were actually not great. Like, it was a 50-50, you know? Yes,
exactly.
Oh, that's okay. So even if we did like this extremely unlikely and difficult thing, even then you would still, it would be like a coin toss as to whether it would actually limit it that way. So since then I've basically changed my thinking on this. I still very much hate intensely the language of destiny, particularly around like fossil fuels, you know, like the idea that we're sort of destined to use them in a particular way for a particular amount of time.
Right.
That's not true, right? Like that's a fabrication that's used to tactically delay action to stop using fossil fuels. However, it is absolutely true that the 1.5 degrees goal is essentially out of reach, at the very least in terms of passing it.
So I think that the question for me as a communicator is, right, why when the science, you know, again, The Economist, it's a year ago today, cover story, 1.5, toast, started a whole debate in the climate science community and also in communications about, okay, so what does it mean if we keep saying this? What are the implications? I sit there wondering, scratching my head going, okay, well, if it is increasingly in doubt, and humans are always terrible about trying to understand probabilistic communications anyway. Usually we resort to using more metaphors like dice, and that's fine as far as it goes. But most people are only hearing 1.5, anything above bad. You know, you can say all to your blue in the face, every 0.1 degree counts. Yeah, okay, sure, we get that if you're really, really read in. But is there not going to be a cost if we have had all this momentum building up something around 1.5, and I went back and actually looked at like Google Trends to see, am I making this up? Am I actually seeing this more and more frequently? And sure enough, at least for the search data, we are. Over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the incidence of people looking for information on 1.5C.
Yeah.
So if it's true that this has actually become a fixture in communications, so what do we make of the resistance to either change communications on that, or are we simply going to continue to drift in the same way we did during COVID about having a lot of public science messages that increasingly just don't seem to conform to observed reality or the things that other scientists are telling us?
Yeah, COVID's a good comparator, right? Because there's a very different approach. That was an actual demonstration of, if you can call it like this, every degree counts, because the idea behind it is that the greater the urgency with which you act, the more lives you save. And it's right. It's not about the target. It's about the relationship between your actions and how many lives you save. Yeah. And that was the situation from the outset, right? Like there was never any, we've got like a death budget for COVID and we need to stay under this death budget. So we should we should have lockdowns within 2 years or something. Like that would just be absurd.
We are in the UK going through this COVID inquiry at the moment. We're hearing a lot about some of the behind the scenes relationship between the, people talking about targets, people talking about lockdown, and people what actually they were talking about behind the scenes. And I suppose that this relationship between a target as a kind of tactic for mobilization to be able to drive action towards the desirable policy outcome or to avoid harm is great. But I suppose like hearing the, like I was involved in communications for an institution around COVID and looking at how the messaging had to change. Initially masks, no masks, but there's no evidence that masks is going to help slow down transmission. And like anybody with a grade school science kind of background is going to, well, that can't be true. Mm. And as it turns out, we dialed down that messaging because we wanted to preserve PPE supplies for frontline workers and people in critical medical roles.
Yeah.
And that had consequences. The consequences were that we lost a lot of public trust in public health messaging that really we're still living with the consequences of. So I guess that's what my worry is about 1.5C and having built it up. Is that concern you at all?
This is a really important point, which is the sort of relationship between honesty and I guess the sort of paternalism in trying to sort of manage or preempt somebody's emotions, somebody's emotional reaction, or trying to manage their behavior in a way that I find quite distasteful. Very much I believe that the truth should be the primary driver, and then you work communications around that. I don't think that obscuring or hiding or changing something to manage public perception is a sort of good thing. And you can find examples of this. So for instance, you can find people saying, don't talk too much about catastrophic consequences of climate change because people may turn off. Right. And on the other hand, you find people saying, don't be too celebratory when something good happens, because people might go, oh, the job's done. Let's just end all climate action now because something good happened. Right. And I find both approaches preempt reactions in a way that I don't like. So what I've found is to be a lot better is if a scientific paper comes out, like obviously there's debate about the Hansen paper. Right. There's debate about the sort of the science behind it and the mathematics behind it. That is not my area of expertise, but I really enjoy hearing from people whose expertise it is. You mentioned like the responses from Zeke and Michael Mann.
Yeah.
And I have no idea where I stand because I don't know.
same. I'm not going to pretend any special knowledge. I'm just trying to decode with my communications hat on. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. Right. And so my immediate reaction is just simply, this doesn't seem to change a lot about what we do in day to day in terms of the urgency, and particularly it doesn't really sort of change a lot around COP. I guess we'll get to it in a second, but the thing with COP, when you put it in the context of the state of the science, right? So it's worth bringing up one other thing in relation to that I find to be really interesting. So this year, global temperatures have broken a bunch of records by the margin with which they broke the records is itself record-breaking. And you look at charts of this and like my immediate reaction is like, oh, I've mucked up the pivot table or the data or something here. Like I've got to check it.
You see a 0.5 degree C, variance, against the previous record in September. And that's why you hear someone come out with a statement like gobsack, smackingly bananas.
Yeah.
And you don't often hear that language. Yeah.
So you see something. Yeah. Zeke Hausfeld said that. And he did a post on Blue Sky recently. Please join it if you're not on it, audience.
Can I just plus one on that? Double click on that, because I'm enjoying this so much over the last week. I saw that Chris Stark was on there from the Climate Change Committee, and I saw that there's a bunch of other people that I'm following. And it just seems like there's momentum.
Yeah,
and you've done a huge thing, and thank you for that, of helping curate this green sky kind of feed, for the community. So just kudos to you for doing that, and thanks.
Please join your green sky as well. I love having more people on it. It's very good, yeah. and so Zeke posted there basically with a sense of like, you could sort of sense this frustration in his post, which is basically saying, yes, global temperatures this year are quite unprecedented, but it is not outside of the realms of the range of what we forecast. It's kind of just at the top of it, at the top of the range. And, I think, you and I have a sort of similar instinct when we see something like this, which is basically you start thinking about what would average person kind of feel when they saw this. Like I try and put myself in the shoes of somebody who may not be super soaked into all of this kind of information.
Yep.
And I imagine they probably don't care whether it's outside, a little bit outside what was forecast or not outside what was forecast. They care about the threat that it has to their safety. and to their, you know, their street and their house and their family. Like it doesn't really matter whether or not it's unprecedented. And so I sort of see this debate with Hansen in a similar fashion. Not that it doesn't matter, but that it will be received in a sort of very clear way, regardless of, you know, is it accelerating? Is it like accelerating a bit? I don't think people care that much.
I think it's almost like arguing, you know, academics arguing about the parking spaces at the university. It's like the more intense these debates become is because they're so close to each other, actually, compared to the rest of the spectrum of opinion, that the small differences are the ones that actually get the most animated. But anyway, I want to dive a little bit into some of the recent things we're, you know, again, talking about this 3x renewables target, because again, it's kind of a little bit more in a space where you've spent a lot of time thinking and researching. So the IEA, which has obviously gone through almost a renaissance, when I was talking to Michael Barnard recently, you know, he was talking about how, you know, Fatih Birol is slowly, slowly nudging the ship away from this being, you know, this oil consumer club to one that actually is getting a little better about forecasting for, you know, solar and, you know, wind expansion, et cetera. So obviously IEA's had a huge amount of reports over the last, you know, few weeks. They've done an amazing data dump, a lot to chew on. And you've been really digging into the data. I think one of the arguments that Fatih Birol seems to have picked in particular is on fossil peaking. And OPEC had a very strong reaction, not surprisingly, to that. What's, first of all, your take on, you know, where the IEA has gotten to? With, and let's talk about fossil peaking for a second before getting into, I know you've got some views on solar.
Yeah, so, you know, the IEA has actually been packing a sort of soon coming peak for fossil fuels into their scenarios for a few years now. I think I need to dig into some of the older ones, but I think it's from 2019 onwards, a straight line upwards into the future was just absurd to them. Like they were like, that's it, that's done. And, you know, pretty reasonable move. What was so earth-shattering, I guess, with this one is that this is they've put that into their. If imagine the absurd scenario, if no one ever made any new climate policies ever, fossil fuels would still reach a maximum in the next few years, and then start to fall after that. Which is such a dramatic and emotional story to me, because it packs this inevitability. You can't turn the ship around, even if you were to try. I mean, you probably could if you really wanted to, if you had like infinite money and there was enough sort of catastrophe and war and things like that, but it's just extremely improbable, right? Like it would be an amount of effort that you just can't do. And so that's great. You know, I really, that actually does mean something to me. I find that to be, that shifting forecast to be a great thing. And it sort of, as always with the IEA, there's a bit of self-fulfilling influence behind it.
Right.
It changes how investment decisions are made. It changes the flow of money.
Yes.
It remains extremely influential. And so they're thinking about the most probable future changes what the most probable future is.
Absolutely. It feeds into the momentum. When you use language like unstoppable, you know, even people who are just at the periphery making any kind of investment decisions go, okay, well, I guess we're, you know, so if you're, you know, if you're one of the last holdouts in the industrial combustion engine space, you maybe might be thinking, you know what, actually now it's time to throw in the towel. Maybe we won't design any new ICE vehicles. Maybe we just need to do EVs from now on.
Exactly.
We'll stop. So that does matter. I agree.
The word unstoppable is really important. Because it's sort of, you have to treat it in two ways, right? The first thing that you should do is feel a little bit good about it, because it's not something that just happened by itself. This is decades and decades of hard work from, you know, many different people, many of whom, you know, just like don't even get recognized for it. It's just a huge amount of human effort that has gone into creating the situation.
Yeah.
So fantastic. But it is slow downable. It may not be reversible or stoppable, but it is very slow downable.
And let's talk about that for a minute, because I think that with solar in particular, I mean, again, you're a big fan of S-curves. You're even more data than me. So, I mean, and solar, obviously, it's now become the story. And paired with that has been, and you're an old wind guy, not old, but you've had a lot of wind background. The wind sector is going through some things at the moment. And we're seeing, so I can imagine there being a lot of transference of like, okay, well, if wind stalls, in terms of You know, right now that projection of like, or the target of getting to 3,500 gigawatts of wind capacity globally, if we somehow plateau and onshore and offshore wind basically don't get the growth rates that we thought, and now we're seeing solar hockey stick, oh, that must be great because that means we can make up the difference with solar. Tell me what you think, what the data is telling you.
solar will experience this moment at some point in the future as well. It just has to. There's no infinite sort of exponential curve. And I think that the characteristics, particularly for utility scale solar, make it vulnerable to the similar dynamics for wind. There's the development structures, you know, these are companies that need to make profits, and, you know, it's a complicated process to ensure that investors sort of have the confidence in these sort of longer term projects. The community responses, I think this is a big chunk of my book, it's the community responses to wind. At the very end of it, I talk about the potential for this happening with solar as well. And it basically happens for utility scale solar pretty frequently, right? But it's a little bit easier for solar developers because the sun falls relatively evenly across Earth's surface, whereas wind is a very precious resource. I think that you have to acknowledge that there are some inherent characteristics between the two technologies that make wind a bit more vulnerable to like supply chain pressures and like shaky investors, you know, nervous investors, and also to community, like failed community processes, right? That's playing out in the data, right? Which is that wind is globally, it's growing, of course, but the rate of growth is starting to see a worrying sort of change.
Right.
When you zoom down into specific countries, it looks really bad. Like some of the countries that have had the most wind growth are seeing the most stalling. And I should just quickly mention, I live in Norway, which has had the single most dramatic sort of that phenomenon that I just described anywhere in the world. Growth in wind power was the highest in Europe in absolute terms. So not even accounting for the fact that we're a small country, in absolute terms, Norway had the most extra megawatts of capacity for 1 year, 2019, the year I arrived here in Norway. And last year it was, I can't remember the number, but it's absurdly small. I think it's like 50 or 60 megawatts of proposed new wind. It's like some industrial park in somewhere in the north. So it's a disaster, right? Like this is really bad. We've got a lot of new power demand from electrification of our vehicle fleet, electrification of industry and homes. It's all happening pretty fast. Data centers, there's a new TikTok data center in Halland. Like it's just sucking up all this power and there's huge dramas going on. Equinor, the state-owned oil and gas company, wants to electrify their gas processing facilities and oil platforms.
Indeed.
There are communities like objecting to the wind farms that they've proposed for those facilities. It's really wild, you know. This is a problem that is manifesting more in wind now, as you would expect, due to the characteristics. But solar is in no way immune to most of these things. It just has more momentum behind it at the moment.
So in terms of the 3x target that, you know, that people have been talking about, I mean, is that something you'd co-sign on? Do you think it's a good thing to be shooting for? You know, does it take our attention away from other things that we might be talking about going into COP very briefly?
Yeah. So something I've been a little bit fascinated in has been instances where renewables have been growing fast, but emissions are not dropping. I mentioned in a LinkedIn post recently, Texas. I actually don't remember if I posted this or not. If I didn't, I will post it. But Texas is an amazing example. Obviously, you know, the largest state in America with the highest power demand and the highest growth in power demand. The reason that is important is because new renewables in Texas, particularly wind, have been filling in growth in demand and not cutting down on emissions. This whole concept of this is basically what you see in the sort of lead up to emissions eventually being cut down into, right? So this happened in Australia. We had a lot of new renewable growth and it was kind of just meeting new demand, and then demand stopped growing. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of utilities were like, oh no, our coal and gas plants are not generating as much as they used to, and we don't like this at all. And they decided that they wanted to attack the renewable energy target. And so, you know, basically what you need to have is three things happening simultaneously. First, renewables need to be growing as kind of as fast as you can muster, as long as you, you know, you have like good environmental and social sort of limits in place to make sure that you're not stabbing yourself in the foot as we did here in Norway. And then the second thing that needs to happen is demand needs to be either growth needs to be limited or it needs to be dropping. That can be like energy efficiency, or it can be like sufficiency, which is covered in the recent IPCC report. And then the third thing that needs to be happening is limitations on fossil fuel. I'm talking about power grids here, but you can generalize this to like across the sector, across all sectors.
Sure.
You need to have limitations on fossil fuel consumption, right? So in the US, for instance, you had this whole time period where it was like, oh, gas is a transition fuel. You know, it's a bridge fuel to kind of like get from one spot to the other spot. But because there were no limitations on its usage, it became, it was not a bridge fuel. It just basically replaced coal in its entirety. You know, like emissions from producing that power fell a bit, but not as fast as it should have. What we're going to see at COP for sure is the renewables goal gets kind of talked about in a sort of a sense of isolation. The implications of a tripling of renewables, which is a subsequent massive reduction in consumption of coal, oil, and gas, will not be talked about too much. Or that's the goal.
Okay, well, look. I get you. So I think, look, I'm conscious that we're coming up towards time, and I know you have to go to another thing. So I really appreciate, I want to give you a couple of quick fire questions before we let you go.
Yeah,
that's all right. So first is, I think one of the things about the uncertainty about, you mentioned about investment decisions being affected by these debates, both the IEA, you know, the communications coming out from institutions like that, but also this, you know, kind of debates around the science. So I was listening to a different podcast where I heard Carolyn Funk from Blue Bear Capital based in San Francisco talking about she's holding back on further thinking about climate tech investments, particularly when it comes to adaptation, particularly when it comes to other things, because she's waiting to, you know, she thinks it's going to be a couple of years before we see more data about where temperatures will land. And that's going to be both a mix of the policy stuff, you know, how the science and the atmosphere chemistry work out, and also what we see coming out of COP. But in terms of where she's ready, you know, she's holding back, placing her next set of bets until she's gotten more data about where those bets can be placed in a more intelligent way based on where she thinks we're going to end up in terms of temperatures, which is an interesting signal. And, you know, Blue Bear is one of the OG investors in the space. So hearing someone like that talk in that terms is slightly concerning to me. That's something that you think about at all in terms of like how that's going to affect capital allocations?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think that that there's a secondary conversation which I find to be quite daunting, but I follow closely the people who actually know about it and talk about it around climate risk. So this is basically two different categories. One is the impacts of climate change on your investments and things like that, and then also the impacts of the change of the speed of the transition on your investments. A good example is all of the massive investments in new gas projects. So not just in the US, but in Australia as well. I've been tracking a few. And then we've obviously got a lot of planned oil and gas expansion here in Norway. And people sort of criticize it on the grounds of like, well, you shouldn't really be putting the money into those things because you will not recover the cost of capital. People will just demand fossil fuels far less than you think they will.
Right.
It's sort of predicated on this assumption of like, again, inevitability. Like this is my projection. This is the future that I think is definitely going to happen. And I think less and less in those terms. I think more and more it depends very much on what we do, how we act. The actual change in temperatures and climate impacts and stuff like that feels a bit more alien to me because it's not really, a lot of a big chunk of what we experience over the next sort of 5 to 10 years will be the consequences of our past actions, not the consequences of things that we decide today and tomorrow.
I think if your investment time horizon is a little bit further out, you're deciding like which early stage startups pre-commercialized to back, you know, which kind of really blue sky technologies you're trying to decide, like I'll put some, you know, she's a very focused investor. She doesn't do spray and pray. So I think she's kind of well-read in deciding like this. It's just, interesting signal for me that that was something on her mind as a material risk affecting her investment decision-making. Second thing, are you more optimistic or pessimistic than you were when you wrote Windfall?
Oh man, I actually think I'm more optimistic, which is strange because in many senses, you could argue that the just the raw numbers are worse in many regards. The forecasts are better, but the measurements of what's happening now are not better. So I try to focus entirely on measurements and like what's the current, what was generated, like what were emissions in the past year, not what are the forecasts for the next 5 years. Which is so strange, but the reason that I've certainly not been too, that isn't sort of knocking me into a state of pessimism, is because the sort of society, like the collective movements and the structures around in the climate movement, they have themselves have grown up a bit. We've kind of come out of our teenage years. We're starting to get a really good spread across many, many different segments of society. It's not just like focused on a few different things anymore. This idea that we're too obsessed with like renewables and EVs and stuff like that, that's kind of outdated. You can just read and you read about climate news and you read every day, like there's fights about gas stoves. There's fights about like getting steel companies to decarbonize. There's fights about, like large tech companies and how they're doing their sustainability. This is really a broad spread. And it looks a bit more disjointed or sort of like a bit of a mess across every segment of human society, but this is exactly what we should be doing. It doesn't look like one single movement anymore. Right. And that's not a problem. That's a really good thing. We're actually sort of doing everything at once. And I like that. That actually makes me quite happy and feel pretty good about this. Yeah.
Well, that's excellent. And then finally, before I ask you for some recommendations. So climate tech, that's our beat. That's what we talk about here. You know, we talk to founders, we talk to investors. And I think there's a lot of nervousness about talking too much about the policy environment from them. It's something you pay a lot of attention to. And I think, like yourself, a lot of people try to stay out of it until they wind up getting mugged, you know, by a PR campaign on the other side, which I think, you know, people can read your book to get a little more details on. But, you know, what's your advice to people working in the sector about how they should approach, you know, communicating about these kind of public issues in ways that might make them uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think I have to bring it back to something I'm working on right at the moment, which is carbon removal startups and sort of companies. I've sort of been doing carbon market stuff for, you know, a couple of years now, and very, very, very keenly aware of all of the problems that have ossified in that sector over the past few years. And so I had a lot of optimism and a lot of hope for the for these sort of young companies, you know, a year ago. But I've seen a lot of sort of hand waving of problems and sort of basically saying like, look, you know, because it's urgent, we need some cash, so it's okay for us to do like a partnership with a fossil fuel company or something like that. And I think that the context, which we'll see again at COP play out in a lot of detail, is that there are people out there who really want to prolong. Again, like I said before, it's slow downable. Even if it's a decline, they want that decline to be as shallow as possible. And they're more than happy to use like a sort of, like a carbon removal excuse and kind of say, well, yeah, that's cool. You know, I'll just slap a Bex on it and it will be fine. I would basically say you basically have no option but to engage with the sort of broader context. Because you really don't want to be taken for a ride. You don't want to get used by people with bad intentions. Yeah.
That's, I think, a really good piece of advice. And then finally, I mean, like Neal Stephenson, one of my favorite authors, I mean, like I, you know, for those who don't know, Cryptonomicon or Snow Crash, where the metaverse came from in terms of that that book, or Seven Eves or Termination Shock. He's one of the best writers around, in my view, you know, particularly thinking about things in this space. And you know, his view is that he's basically doing all this communications, all this writing, because otherwise, you know, it's basically good for his mental health. I find similar things. How do you find, you know, kind of keeping up your communications now that you're kind of have a little more mixed, you're not writing all the time and have your bylines appear in The Guardian and other places? How do you keep yourself motivated to keep yourself going?
Actually, this is partly why I've been putting so much like time and effort into trying to cultivate a sort of stronger community on Blue Sky. Like, I don't think that Blue Sky has any guarantee that it's going to be as big a social network as Twitter was back in the day. But, you know, a big chunk of it is it's really nice and it feels really fun to cultivate, like, the growth of a new community. It made me realize, you know, building something from the ground up is a lot more fun than kind of just existing on something that's kind of growing a little bit stagnant. as you mentioned, I write a lot less. I don't like that very much. I want to write a bit more. But since Twitter basically stopped existing, I have actually reduced my social media usage in general. And I've been reading a lot more, and I haven't read for a long time. I'm currently reading, boring decision, but Ministry for the Future, which is, you know, a compulsory book, and I still hadn't read it, so I'm halfway through it. And it is an amazing feeling. And I had no idea. I had forgotten how good it feels to just kind of just sit there and read. So that is something that is helping a lot as well. In addition to kind of just like building new spaces and thinking about new ways to do this, what we do, reading is, yeah, wow. It's nice to read words.
Amazing. It's nice. Cause so Kim Stanley Robinson. Yeah. I've heard a lot of people say it's like, who has listened to Fred Fukuyama actually giving out about it, saying like, it's like listening to, you know, a lecture on slow speed. I didn't find it that way. I think having read his Mars trilogy stuff, I think that maybe I'm just giving him the benefit of the doubt and reading things that aren't necessarily there. But good for you for keeping going with it. Finally, on that point, I mean, we ask people who come on the show, are there three things that you'd recommend? Again, everyone's going to have a name for it. We call it catalysts. You know, three things that you would have read or watched or listened to, particularly now we've got more of that, that have kind of shaped your views on climate tech or climate more broadly that you might recommend to people listening?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not explicitly like a climate tech thing, but it actually relates quite closely to a lot of issues that I think people working on climate tech would face. So the history of public relations in general, and then specifically the history of public relations in the context of fossil fuels, this is something that is very, very important for all new forms of technology, or people working on new forms of technology to understand, because you will either need to talk about your technology or you will be on the receiving end of people with competing technologies who want to use these techniques. So there's a really great podcast series called Drilled. It's run by Amy Westervelt, one of the, you know, best climate journalists in the world. And season three of it is called The Mad Men of Climate Change. And it's about basically the sort of how closely the history of PR is linked with fossil fuels. That actually changed a lot for me. I think it sort of made me rethink my own attitude and approach towards communications. Taking a bit more of like a humble approach, being less, you know, oh, I'm just trying to pull the levers of everyone's feelings and behavior, you know, the sort of marketing industry style. I was like, I don't think that's going to be me. So that was a really good one.
Right.
I would recommend it's a newsletter that I subscribe to, and it's called Coal Wire. And it's run by a guy called Bob Burton. He's an Australian. It's really just one of the best newsletters I've subscribed to. It is really just like packed with so much information about the coal industry, and very much like the good stuff and the bad stuff, right? Like the good news about like this coal plant is, you know, cancelled or whatever, but then, you know, China's recent investments in a whole bunch of new ones or something like that. That really gives you such a totally realistic It's a bit of a slap in the face. Like, I'm constantly reading about all the successes of renewables, and then I sort of read that and I'm like, oh, okay, Indonesia exists, right? Or Poland exists. So from a technological perspective, it reminds you of the sort of other half of the equation. Yeah, so
Bumper, you know.
Coalwire, yeah. Very, very good newsletter. My third thing is a really great newsletter by a guy called Michael Thomas, called Distilled. He is really focused on the myths and the disinformation around renewables and electric cars and things like that, and I guess the sort of disinformation campaigns that are going on around this. This is actually really important.
Yes.
It's kind of somewhat gone a little bit out of fashion to talk too much about like this kind of thing, but disinformation is still a really massive thing. Like, this is, it's not like climate denial anymore, but it's in many ways worse. And so I think it's important to remain really vigilant about it. And Michael Thomas does a really good job of tracking it. So I would recommend checking out his work.
We're a big fan of the newsletter format here at Wicked Problems, which you can, of course, subscribe to ours at news.wickedproblems.uk. Also get this and other podcasts. But Ketan Joshi, I know we've kept you over time. I'm very grateful. Thank you. So thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you for more of your Blue Sky work? What are the coordinates?
Yeah, ketanjoshi.co on Blue Sky, if you're on there. If not, you can actually find me on LinkedIn. I've been posting a lot more on LinkedIn, just longer format stuff and charts and things like that. It's been really fun being a little bit cheeky there and trying to get a bit of a rise out of the oil and gas guys and stuff like that. It's I'm enjoying it. It's good.
I've observed some of it. I mean, I think you're not quite in the Michael Barnard league of hitting people with a hammer, but there's definitely echoes there somewhere. But listen, Ketan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Enjoy it. Hopefully it's a beautiful day in Oslo there.
Thanks so much to Ketan Joshi for joining us for this conversation. I really enjoyed it. Fantastic. And you will find links to the things we discussed in the show notes, including where to find Ketan and indeed myself on Blue Sky and the Green Sky group that he has curated. So I hope we will see you there soon. Be patient. It will be worth the wait. Amy Jaffe has been wondering where Energy Twitter is going to migrate to. I think we have an answer now. It's like Energy Twitter. It's so much better over at Green Sky. Do check out our newsletter at news.wickedproblems.uk. Let us know your ideas for other guests or topics we should be covering. We'll be back Monday with the second part of this series and featuring my conversation with Susan Joy Hassel. It is not to be missed. If you enjoy the show, do leave a rating or review in your favorite podcast app where you found us. It does help other people to find the show. And looking forward to having Claire Brady back as our co-host next week. She says a couple things going on, so we're looking forward to that. And have a great rest of your weekend.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awakes. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.